From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, The Politics of Rage, we talk with Dan Carter about his new biography of George Wallace, the four-time governor of Alabama and four-time presidential campaigner. Wallace established himself as an opponent of integration. Carter says Wallace also played on distrust of the federal government and a nostalgia for traditional values, thus paving the way for the new conservatism that transformed American politics. Also, commentator Gerald Early reflects on his wife's new position as the president of the St. Louis Junior League. She's the first African-American to hold that position. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new live recording of a 1959 performance by the late violinist Erica Marini. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The White House is less than enthusiastic today about a proposal yesterday by the National Governors Association to reshape the nation's Medicaid program. White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry said the administration is concerned about the way the plan will work, but at the Governors Association meeting today, President Clinton said he appreciates the spirit of bipartisanship and compromise reflected in their proposal. Republican presidential hopefuls Phil Gramm and Lamar Alexander are assuring Iowa corn growers that they strongly support the corn-based fuel ethanol. Alexander is also warning that rival Steve Forbes poses a threat to the nation's ethanol industry. From member station KUNI, Bill Menner reports.
Gramm and Alexander took turns promoting their respective farm policies during speeches today to the Iowa Corn and Soybean Associations in Des Moines. Gramm said he supports existing tax breaks for ethanol, which provides a 600 million bushel market for U.S. corn. Alexander echoed that sentiment, but ripped Steve Forbes for his willingness to reconsider federal support for ethanol if that fuel proves ineffective.
Phasing out federal support for ethanol would be flat wrong for Iowa and flat wrong for this country. And anyone from the real world would know that.
Alexander said this was the, quote, wrong time to jerk the rug out from under corn growers in America. Both Alexander and Gramm are in the state looking to boost support in the final days before next Monday's Iowa precinct caucuses. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Menner in Des Moines.
The government will be picking up most of the bill for First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton's book tour. Government and industry representatives estimate that use of Air Force jet on the tour will wind up costing taxpayers more than $50,000. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
A spokesman for the First Lady says the Secret Service asked her to use a government plane because of security reasons. Mrs. Clinton's publisher, Simon & Schuster, will be picking up an estimated 20% of the bill. Her staff says most of the proceeds from Mrs. Clinton's book will be going to children's hospitals and other private charities. There is precedent for having the government pick up most of the bill for such a book tour. Barbara Bush used a military jet in her travels to promote a book about the first dog, Millie, that became a bestseller. When House Speaker Newt Gingrich took trips to promote his book last year, he paid for his airfare, but the government paid to have plainclothes policemen accompany him. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
There's been an art theft in New York. New York Newsday reports three works of art, including two Picassos, were stolen at Kennedy Airport last week. The paintings and a drawing are worth an estimated $15 million. They were apparently brought to New York by a Mexican businessman for appraisal at Sotheby's and Christie's auction houses. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 39 points at 5445.52, volume 378 million shares. The Nasdaq is up more than 3 points at 1086.36. This is NPR News. PLO leaders were unsuccessful today in an effort to set a date for a vote on changing the group's charter to remove a call for the destruction of Israel. Members of the PLO's executive committee met twice today in the Egyptian city of El Arish, but could not reach agreement. Israel has threatened to halt troop pullbacks in the West Bank and delay negotiations in May on a final peace settlement unless the PLO follows through on Yasser Arafat's promise to remove the language from the charter. Panama may face U.S. trade sanctions if it doesn't crack down on international copyright violations. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama.
The Nintendo Corporation of America has requested that the U.S. government blacklist the Republic of Panama for continued violations of international copyright laws. The request comes as a result of the sales of illegal copies of popular electronic games by Panamanian companies that operate out of the Colón Free Zone. Nintendo Corporation of America and other U.S. corporations insist that Panamanian authorities are not prosecuting companies and individuals that sell copies of well-known products without paying the required royalties. Under existing U.S. legislation, Panama could suffer severe trade sanctions if it allows international commercial piracy to continue. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
According to a report in today's Wall Street Journal, federal officials are looking into charges that the nation's third-largest tobacco company tried to intimidate a witness against the firm. The allegations involve former Brown & Williamson executive Jeffrey Wigand, who was a key witness in two federal probes in the tobacco industry. A man reputed to be one of the top drug lords in Mexico pleaded innocent to drug and money laundering charges today in Houston. Juan Garcia Abrego was arrested last month near Monterrey, Mexico. He was transferred to Houston, Texas. If convicted on all of the charges, Abrego could go to jail for life. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. At the peak of the civil rights era in the early 60s, Alabama Governor George Wallace built his career on opposing integration. In a new biography of Wallace, Dan Carter writes that Wallace also laid the foundation for the conservative counter-revolution of the 70s and 80s. His approach combined fears about race with anti-communism, anti-Washington feelings, cultural nostalgia, and conservative economics. Wallace served four terms as governor of Alabama beginning in 1963, and he campaigned for the presidency four times. Now at the age of 76, he's very ill, deaf, and bedridden, living in Montgomery. Carter's new biography is called The Politics of Rage. Carter is a professor of history at Emory University, president of the Southern Historical Association, and author of a previous book on the Scottsboro Boys. Carter told me how Wallace anticipated the themes of the conservative groundswell which began in the 70s.
If you look at the issues that made Wallace a national figure, you begin with race, of course. But the fact is, after the 1964, Wallace may have used coded language to talk about race, but those weren't his main themes. His main themes were the disintegration of American culture and values, although he would never have used those words. He talked about the way in which Americans were under siege, and he put his finger on that growing sense of unease that I think reaches its culmination in the 80s and 90s, in which middle-class, working-class Americans feel like the country's off track. And Wallace is not, I mean, what he does is he finds those issues, those social issues, as they came to be called, that excite the electorate in a way that they become the themes of the politics of the late 60s, 70s, and into the 80s.
Well, I think it would be interesting to have you read a couple of excerpts of his inaugural speech, the first time he was elected governor of Alabama. And which year is this?
This is 1963. He's January 1963. He's elected the previous year. He's now taking office.
Read an excerpt of that address for us.
It begins not with the reference specifically to race that comes and that everyone remembers from the inaugural address. It begins with a general kind of discussion about the role of the White South, or the South, and he associated the White South with the South, as a besieged region. And let me just read here a short section. There were no government handouts after the Civil War, no Marshall Plan aid, no coddling to make sure that our people would not suffer. Instead, the South was set upon by the vulturous carpetbagger and federal troops. There was no money, no food, no hope of either. But our grandfathers bent their knee only in church and bowed their head only to God.
What's the significance of his reference there to federal troops? What's he referring to?
Well, he's referring to the post-Civil War period when, for a brief period of time, during the so-called Reconstruction period after the American Civil War, federal troops were stationed in the South to protect the right of the emancipated slave to vote and to prevent a kind of violent counter-revolution by white Southerners. But, of course, it assumes a kind of mythology by the end of the 19th and early 20th century in which white Southerners, I mean, in a sense, they're the ultimate victims in American society. At least they see themselves as such. They've been oppressed. They've been oppressed by the federal government during the Reconstruction, and they see this long tradition of outsiders, even before the Civil War, abolitionists, Yankees, who are trying to change their way of life.
But that theme is even continuing into the civil rights movement, and I think he's referring to that too.
Absolutely. And he sees this having a kind of historical tradition. And I should say, he sees this. He's actually reading here a speech, of course, which was written by his speechwriter, a man named Asa Carter, who was a Ku Klux Klan organizer and a rather brilliant polemicist for the segregationist South. But he agreed with it. Even though the words weren't his own, he certainly agreed with them.
So when Wallace starts ringing this theme of, you know, we only bow our heads to God and church and, you know, not to the federal troops that the government sends down, what's he referring to in the civil rights movement?
Well, of course, he's talking about the increasing importance of the role of the federal government, first the courts and then tentatively in the Kennedy administration, then even more so in the Johnson administration, the commitment of the national government to protecting the rights of black citizens in the South. To him and to many white Southerners, it's simply one more in the long train of these actions by the federal government that that are attempting to change our Southern way of life, as it would have been called in the 1940s and 1950s. And it has a clear racial context, as he's speaking in 1963.
I'm going to ask you to read another excerpt of that 1963 inaugural address, which contains an excerpt that contains the most famous line from that address.
Well, in fact, it's the only line. This is the only line that George Wallace, that he uttered, that ends up in Bartlett's familiar quotations. I'm not sure that's the one he would have preferred, but here it is. After talking about the way in which the white South, he says, has been oppressed, or the South, which he always identifies with the white South, he issues what he calls his call to arms. Today I have stood where once Jefferson Davis stood and took an oath to my people. It is very appropriate, then, that from this cradle of the Confederacy, this very heart of the great Anglo-Saxon Southland, we sound the drum for freedom. In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny. And I say, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever.
And that segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, that's the phrase that made it into Bartlett's.
That's it. And it in effect amounts to a kind of Faustian bargain for Wallace, because he's now at the very beginning of his career. He's so closely and intimately associated himself with the defense of segregation, racism, that he'll never be able to completely get rid of that albatross around his neck. But he eventually does, because he does broaden it. Originally, his attacks on the federal government were dismissed by individuals, by most observers, commentators, as simply a reflection of this white Southern paranoia in the South. And the genius of Wallace is that he manages to break out of that mold that has kept white Southern segregationist politicians like Orville Faubus and Ross Barnett and Strom Thurmond and others in a kind of exclusive Southern box, so that by the time he moves into these campaigns for the presidency in 64 and 68 and 72 and 76, the overtones, the racial overtones are still there, but he takes that Southern racial stand against the federal government and broadens it and makes it much more than just a racial issue.
What does he make it into?
Well, he makes it in, he convinces, he had no trouble convincing white Southerners in 1963 that the federal government was their enemy, or at least most white Southerners who saw, didn't want to change race relations in the South. The federal government was trying to change them. It was their enemy. But what he succeeds in doing, and it takes years of constant agitation, if you will, he develops a kind of ear for the way in which other Americans, not just white Southerners, see the federal government as their enemy. He begins with race. But think about the things that happened during the 1960s, the sense of social dislocation, the rise in crime, the turmoil in the streets that come with the anti-war movement, the way in which Americans sense that they've lost their moral bearings, rise of pornography, the Supreme Court decisions outlawing school prayer. all of these things, Wallace very, very astutely blames upon the federal government. If we're having a rise in crime, it's because you've got federal judges, the Supreme Court and other federal judges, who are essentially turning criminals loose on the street. If you've got a problem of a loss of moral bearings in American society, it's because we've banned God from the classroom. And who is it that have done these things? It's the institutions, courts, the president, even the Congress, who have committed these crimes against the American people.
Now, is there anything new about this theme when Wallace starts playing it?
It's not so much new. I mean, you can find echoes of both the style and the issues. And in some ways, it's a very traditional kind of paranoid anti-intellectualism that Richard Hofstadter talked about 40, 50 years ago, a style that you see in American politics going back into the 19th century. But what Wallace anticipates as early as the early 1960s, I mean, think about it. This is the heyday of the civil rights movement, the heyday of American liberalism. The election of 1964 seems to be a referendum in which Lyndon Johnson has captured the crest of this wave of liberalism that is finally triumphant, that is a kind of culmination of everything that's taken place in American politics since the 1930s. And what Wallace senses, as early as 63 and 64, is that it's more than just a handful of cranks, more than just a bunch of white segregationists who are uneasy, resistant to the triumphal federal state. And he senses that because he has this kind of sixth sense about politics. And he begins hammering away at these anti-federal themes. And gradually he moves away from this very narrow southern base and moves, in fact, rather quickly, I think, into a national constituency.
Dan Carter is my guest, and he's the author of a new biography of George Wallace called The Politics of Rage. Actually, that's another theme of your book, that when he moves away from the politics of race and talks about other issues that he feels affect a lot of other people in the South, that he changes the role of the South in American politics.
Well, it would be too much to say that George Wallace is responsible for the Southernization of American politics, as one writer called it. But he clearly, despite his own limitations, and he had serious limitations as a national communicator, particularly in the age of television. Nevertheless, he does succeed in as I said, ending the kind of isolation of the political voice of the South, the conservative political voice of the South. In the election, the presidential campaigns of 64 and 68, particularly 1968, I think, there's a kind of seems a kind of frivolous kind of issue, but as late as 1968, when Richard Nixon and Hubert running as a Republican candidate, Hubert Humphrey's a Democrat, and Wallace is the independent third party candidate, Nixon was extremely reluctant to do anything that might be seen as appealing to the Wallace constituency, at least overtly. Even in matters of style, this, as I said, Terry, this sounds trivial, but some of his aides who were more familiar with, I think, what was happening in America, for example, wanted them to use country music jingles, wanted them to use these in his campaigns. And Nixon's advisors said, no, this is not dignified. Well, when Wallace captured 15% of the vote, and at one time he had almost about 25% of the American people who said they were going to vote for him, then all of a sudden it may not have been dignified anymore, but it became more mainstream. That is, in the sense, the Southern aspects of Wallace that seemed to mark him outside the mainstream, more and more make him part of that central flow of American politics.
How did George Wallace use religion in his political campaigns?
Well, that's an interesting question, because in his actual campaigns himself, a lot of secular reporters and news people who covered him sort of tried not to laugh as they were describing it, but it seemed so 1920s. It just didn't seem very modern and up to date. All his campaign rallies would begin with "God Bless America," and some patriotic songs, and then a prayer, often a very long and impassioned evangelical prayer. And when he started this in the 1960s, particularly in some of his tours around the West Coast and the Upper Midwest and the Northeast, it seemed so Southern and so out of step with modern American society. Well, in many ways, of course, Wallace's campaigns, what he was picking up on was the resurgence, which was going on and almost undetected by the news media, of the rise of a conservative religious right, which was taking place before our eyes. We just didn't see it in the 1960s.
Dan Carter is my guest, and he's written a new biography of George Wallace, the former governor of Alabama and the longtime campaigner for the U.S. presidency. And this new biography is called The Politics of Rage. Let's take a short break, and then I'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dan Carter, and he's written a new biography of George Wallace, the former governor of Alabama. Now, Wallace is most famous for being a racist, but you say that he didn't start his political career on race issues.
No, and one of the, I understand that everyone's interested in the long-term implications of Wallace, and I am too. But when I tried to write this book, I was also trying to write about a time and a place which was not our own. And Wallace grew up in that that time and place, the Deep South of the 1920s and 1930s. And in a sense, it's not our own time. You can't exactly compare it in terms of racial attitudes or anything else. But it's clear that by the standards of the 1930s and the 1940s, George Wallace was a moderate. One might even call him a moderate liberal on race. Probably the most influential political figure in his career was Big Jim Folsom of Alabama, a kind of almost a unique figure in Southern politics who avoided racism and in fact, treated his black constituents fairly and refused to use racism. That was the early Wallace, not the one that we came to know.
What changed him?
Well, it's ambition. George Wallace had certain feelings about. He didn't feel, he wasn't strongly racist, perhaps, but the thing that he really wanted was power. He used to say this to his members of his family, that he was, there were only two things important in life, money and power. He was never going to have money, but he was going to have power. And that meant that in the late 1950s, when he made his first campaign for the governorship in Alabama, he encountered the fact the dilemma that in order to be elected, you had to be an extremist on race. There were no black voters in Alabama. Emotions were inflamed after Little Rock, and the race issue was foremost. He tried to be a moderate in 1958, and he lost. He lost to a hardline segregationist named John Patterson. And when he did, that was it. He did an about-face, or at least, if not 180 degrees, about 90 degrees, and embraced the politics of race.
Excuse my language here, but what he said after he lost to Patterson was, "No one will ever out-nigger me again."
That was his, the night that he lost, when he was extremely bitter over what he felt like was Patterson's successful use of the race issue. And yes, that's what he told his friends. And he later denied that he had made this statement, but at least one individual who was there that night insists that he was emphatic. And this is what he said, Star Smith, who was a newsman at the time. And in the years that followed, he said essentially the same thing to other people, that like it or not, that you were going to have to play the race issue.
Of course, a lot of the civil rights struggles were played out in Alabama. I think the most famous image of George Wallace is when he stood in the doorway at the University of Alabama in an attempt to prevent the university's desegregation. And, of course, the federal government was insisting that African-American students be allowed to attend. Tell us a little bit about his, what you know of his thinking behind that move.
I've sometimes quoted the proverb, supposedly it's a Middle Eastern proverb, that a man is made powerful by having powerful enemies. And in 1963, George Wallace understood that John Kennedy and the Kennedy administration was well on its way to being the most hated president in the White South since the days of the Civil War and Reconstruction. And so he courted a confrontation with the Kennedy administration and went out of his way to set it up. I don't think George Wallace ever had any illusions in the back of his mind. He knew that he was going to have to back down. But he wanted to set it up so that he could become the defender of the White South, the defender of traditional values at that point of the White South, that is, the defense of segregation. And so and I have a great deal of sympathy for the Kennedy administration, but he played the Kennedy administration like a superb angler, keeping him on the hook at all times, never letting them know what he was going to do, holding out at least the threat of violence, which had occurred the previous year when the administration tried to integrate the University of Mississippi. And as a result, he was essentially able to lay out the groundwork for a kind of confrontation. It was a mock confrontation. I think it's wonderful that it ends up in Forrest Gump's film Forrest Gump, because that's what it really was, a kind of theatrical confrontation. But it did succeed. It did succeed in placing, as you say, Wallace into this position where there is this very vivid image of him standing up to the Assistant Attorney General of the United States, Nicholas Katzenbach, and through Katzenbach with the Kennedy administration. And from that moment on, as I said, that's part of the albatross of race is going to be around his neck later on, but it gives him extraordinary kind of national attention and a national reputation. One of the most interesting things about that stand in the schoolhouse door was the fact, and I think this even surprised George Wallace, was the outpouring of letters, financial contributions, which began pouring in, not from the South, which he anticipated, but from all over the country. And that's when he really began to grasp the extent of the racial white backlash that was taking place. And the extent to which there was a national constituency for his racial ideas and later his other ideas as well.
Dan Carter is the author of the new biography of George Wallace called The Politics of Rage. Carter is at Cambridge University this semester as a visiting professor of American institutions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Dan Carter about the impact of George Wallace on American politics. Also, Gerald Early reflects on his wife's new position as president of the St. Louis branch of the Junior League. She's the first African-American to hold that position. And Lloyd Schwartz, our classical music critic, reviews a new recording. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview about George Wallace, the four-time governor of Alabama and four-time presidential hopeful. My guest, Jan Carter, has written a new biography of Wallace called The Politics of Rage, in which he traces how Wallace set the stage for the new conservatism that transformed American politics. Wallace built his early career on his opposition to integration in the 60s. What was George Wallace's approach to dealing with civil rights demonstrators?
Well, in the early 1960s, it was leave no heads uncracked. He from the very beginning of his administration, I think it shows. I've tried to be fair to the life of George Wallace and to treat it as a whole, but I think the particular 1963, 64, and 65, you can see Governor Wallace at his most reckless. In terms of the appointments he makes, Al Lengo, I won't say a homicidal, but certainly a psychologically unstable man appointed to be head of the state troops, so-called state troopers. His support for people like Bull Connor in Birmingham, his close associations, as I describe in the book, despite his attempt to cover them up, his close associations with members of the Ku Klux Klan, with a Nazi group that he used, manipulated. He never let them control him, but he used them, cooperated with them in a way that even considering the passions of the 1960s, it's a pretty dark story, I think.
George Wallace made several runs for the presidency. And during those runs, he insisted he wasn't a racist, which was, I think, pretty difficult to insist given his record. How did he change his position and change his rhetoric?
Well, he changed his rhetoric before he changed his position. In the campaign of 1964, he ran in the Democratic primaries against stand-ins for Lyndon Johnson. And his only real issue in 1964 was the pending Civil Rights Act that had been proposed by Kennedy and was pushed through by Johnson. But he never used the word, he never used the N-word, certainly, and he never even talked explicitly about race. He learned very early on that you could use code words. You could use coded language to talk about race without actually appearing to talk about race.
What was his code?
His code was the sanctity of the neighborhood, the sanctity of your union seniority rights. At any point that the federal government, the autonomy of local communities, so that, for example, when the federal government is trying to do something about the blatant discrimination, voting discrimination, that takes place in the South, he says that, that traditionally under the doctrine of states' rights, the states have a right to decide voting requirements, and this is none of the federal government's business. You got a case after case involving civil rights workers in which white juries, all-white juries, whipped up by the passion of the time, acquit men who are clearly guilty of mayhem and murder. And when individuals throughout the country react with righteous indignation, then he treats it as an attack upon the jury system. In other words, never mention the word race, but talk about issues in a and actually talk about them in a context with which most Americans agree. That is, most people do celebrate the importance of community and family and local institutions. There's a long tradition of this. But in at least in the early stages, no one had, I don't think most people had any illusions about what he was really talking about when he talked about the the right of local self-government. He was talking about the right of local self-government to oppress black people.
Do you think that he believed he would ever get elected president?
No. I mean, he may have in a moment of fantasy, but I think toward the end of his political career and talking to some of his friends, he confided that he had always been born, as he said, at the wrong time. And there was a certain, I think there was a certain truth about that. Jimmy Carter, in some ways, was lucky to have come along a little bit later, a Southerner who wasn't caught up in all the passions of the 50s in the same way that George Wallace. He did things, said things that that meant he would never be elected president. And I think George Wallace was smart enough to understand that.
So you think that Wallace, through his coded language, was able to exploit the fears of some Northerners as well as Southerners?
Yes.
Who do you think benefited from those inroads that he made?
Well, Wallace's, I don't want to, I always try to back off. Anyone who does a biography thinks their biographical subject is the most important figure since
yes.
since Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
And I'm not trying to argue that, but Wallace, more than any other single political figure in the 1960s, was the one who played a critical role in breaking loose important parts of the old Democratic coalition, particularly working-class whites, young white males, the so-called Reagan Democrats of the 1980s, are the Wallace Democrats, who first turned and supported Wallace in 1968 and 72, and then tended to go toward Richard Nixon early on and then finally come home to Ronald Reagan. I mean, if you look at the contour of the Wallace vote among independent voters in 1968, you find an interesting kind of profile. They tend to be young, male individuals who were probably leaning toward the Democratic Party but saw themselves as independents, a new generation of voters who were not tied in the same way that their parents were. Well, this was exactly the group that Kevin Phillips and other Republican strategists saw in the 1960s as essential to recovering from the Goldwater debacle of 1964. We've got to get these people in the Republican Party. And Wallace was the figure who, in a sense, cut them loose from the Democratic Party, aroused their anger toward the Democratic Party. After the election of 1968, there was a cottage industry of Republican strategists, led by Kevin Phillips, but included others as well, who looked at the Wallace vote, analyzed and reanalyzed it, and saw it as the key to unlocking this 35-year-old Democratic majority.
My guest, Dan Carter, is the author of a new biography of George Wallace called The Politics of Rage. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Dan Carter is my guest. He's written a new biography of George Wallace, the former governor of Alabama. In 1972, Wallace was shot 3 times by Arthur Bremer. Wallace survived, although he was paralyzed from the waist down. Why was Wallace the target?
Well, it's Governor Wallace himself and many of his former advisors. I just talked to one within the last on the telephone within the last few months. Believe that there was someone in the Nixon administration who set up Arthur Bremer, either persuaded him to do the shooting or in some way encouraged it. This is I guess conspiracy theories flow everywhere. And it was something, I certainly didn't begin with that assumption, but it was something I wanted to keep an open mind about when I started the research. And I was very fortunate because of a third party to locate the large missing section of Arthur Bremer's diary. He had a secret diary he kept, parts of which were recovered after the shooting, but the critical first parts were not. In some ways, I guess it had made a bestseller if I could have proved that there was a secret hand of Richard Nixon or his administration behind it. But in fact, Arthur Bremer was a classic American political assassin, someone who is estranged from society, deeply mentally ill is the best way to describe him, who is interested not in politics. He doesn't. His first target was Richard Nixon. He wanted to shoot Richard Nixon. He mainly wants to make a place for himself in American society, and the only way he knows to do that is to shoot a political figure. He's not the first one to, as we know, to fit that profile.
I think a lot of biographers fall in love with their subjects. What do you feel emotionally toward your subject, George Wallace?
I didn't fall in love with George Wallace. I think a certain sadness. I do feel, and I share, I grew up in the deep rural South, and even though I rejected the kind of racial attitudes that George Wallace had, I can empathize with his sense that of alienation, his sense that white Southerners, and they really do share more than they realize, I think, with black Southerners and other marginal groups in American society, being on the outside. And so in that sense, I have a kind of empathy for George Wallace. And I have a sadness that someone so capable, so intelligent, so with such drive and such ambition should in the end allow his that ambition to lead him to do, it sounds so preacherish, but such horrible things for which I think he is living with the consequences of today. So in the sense, it's a kind of sadness about someone like Wallace.
Did you meet George Wallace ever?
Many years ago, but not when I was working on the book.
And was it a significant meeting?
No, not at all. I heard him speak twice. And now that was actually more important in terms of my longtime fascination with Wallace. I heard him speak in 1964 when I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin, and I saw him come there to a hostile liberal student body and show a side of George Wallace that I also talk about in the book, and that's a very charming side of George Wallace. They came to scoff and stayed to pray, but by the end of the hour, he had them, at least the majority of them, laughing in his and kind of liking him. Then I heard him again in 1968 in Maryland, and listening to him, watching him, was what actually led to this longtime fascination with him.
What did he say on the college campus that turned some of the listeners around?
Well, he, in the first place, I think he had the enormous advantage that, in particularly in 1964, that the students really expected a kind of monster. You know, most people didn't read that closely, and they thought he was going to get up and talk, use racist language, as Ross Barnett had been there 2 weeks before. And he was this pathetic figure out of the 19th century talking about the Negro's this and the Negro's that, and people began laughing at him. Well, Wallace got up, and even though the students may have thought that it was simply a kind of facade, he gave actually a pretty thoughtful kind of talk about the constitutional issues involved in expanding the power of the federal government. And then when the question and answer period came and people would shout these hostile, angry questions, he had a whole series of one-liners. People would heckle him. He had a whole series of one-liners that he had developed over the years, which he would give in this ingratiating kind of "I'm just a not terribly bright country boy from Alabama" kind of way, that kind of won over his audience by the end of the time.
I know you're spending the semester teaching in Cambridge, England, and I don't know how closely you've been able to follow the Republican presidential primary, but I'm wondering if you think about Wallace in hearing any of the campaign speeches and campaign rhetoric this year.
Oh, yes. As I said, there are certainly differences, but Wallace used to complain that he should have copyrighted all his speeches, that Richard Nixon started stealing them, then Ronald Reagan stole them. Sure, you hear the rhetoric of George Wallace. It's different today than it was 25, 30 years ago, but the fundamental kind of hostility toward the national government, that was a part of George Wallace's message is here today, only now it's the dominant message. I mean, when George Wallace first started out, about 75 to 80% of the American people, according to the Gallup polls, believed that the federal government would usually do the right thing. Today, it's exactly reversed. About 75 or 80% of the American people believe that the federal government usually does the wrong thing. And it wasn't George Wallace that caused this. But I think through his life, you can see in his political career, you can see the processes, the way, the very dramatic way in which Americans lost their sense of faith in a national government which had saved them from the Depression and which had created one of the most prosperous societies on earth and in a sense turned against it by the 1980s and 1990s.
Any other echoes of Wallace you hear in the current primary?
Well, there are of course the issues. I never thought that the issue of crime could last. Very few issues in American politics last that long. But I mean, it was, after all, George Wallace who first made crime in the streets a kind of central issue. And now, whereas he started out in a minority, if not of one, at least in a minority, the bloodthirsty cries of American politicians, I mean, it's like they just can't wait to get their hands on the execution lever, it seems to stretch across the political spectrum from left to right, liberal to conservative, Republican to Democrat. And, I hear George Wallace. His voice was angrier. It wasn't as polished. He didn't have his hair and set in the right way for television. But, yes, I hear George Wallace every time I pick up a newspaper magazine about the American campaign. He's there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Deanne Carter's new biography of George Wallace is called The Politics of Rage. This semester, Carter is a visiting professor of American institutions at Cambridge University in England. It's still not uncommon for an African American to find that he or she is the first person of color to become the head of his or her group. Commentator Gerald Early's wife is in that position now, in a group that he was once willing to dismiss.
When my wife Ida joined the Junior League of St. Louis 8 years ago, I knew very little about the organization. I guess at the time I thought of it as something like the Daughters of the American Revolution, a gathering of upper-crust, debutante-type white women, matrons and dowagers, who did some insignificant charity work. All I could remember about the Junior League at the time was that Margaret Mitchell, the author of Gone with the Wind, was blackballed by the Atlanta chapter, in part because she did her probationary volunteer work at the Black and Charity wards of the Grady Hospital, and in part because she was too independent. "So they're allowing your type in the Junior League," I said to Ida when she joined. "Well, there goes the neighborhood." She smiled slightly, reminding me that other black women were members, including, at that time, Cardinal shortstop Ozzie Smith's wife. "The Junior League is not what it was in 1920, she said. "We're reaching out." During the years that followed, Ida has worked unceasingly for the League, attending meetings at all hours, traveling across the country. Ida eventually became an officer in the St. Louis chapter and a board member of the National Umbrella Organization. In December, Ida learned that she had been selected president of the St. Louis chapter. She is the first African American ever chosen to be president of this chapter, and only among a handful of black women ever to be chosen president of any Junior League chapter. She is also among only one or two other non-native St. Louisans ever chosen to be president, significant because St. Louis can be fairly provincial. In short, in at least the annals of local history, this is no small feat. Moreover, this culmination of Ida's public career as a volunteer gives me pause to reflect upon both her and the women with whom she has shared so much time with over the last 8 years. I realize that, as a result of the Junior League, Ida is one of the most admired women, black or white, in St. Louis. "You don't take us seriously because we're women," Ida said. But as time went on, I grew more deeply impressed by Ida's commitment to the goals of the organization, training women for leadership in their communities. Ida used to grit her teeth when female academic colleagues of mine berated Junior League as bourgeois social climbing that supported the patriarchy. I work just as hard for women as they do, she would say to me. I do not get paid, and I feel my work will have a greater impact on St. Louis. I'm no man-clinger. I'm not ashamed that I'm middle class, and I'm not apologizing for it, and I'm damn tougher than any of them. Over the years of her involvement, Ida became more ornery and self-determined. She stood up for unpopular causes like allowing men to join the league. She learned how to talk with and engage a variety of people, from unwed teenage mothers to rich art collectors. She learned how to become a leader among a group of competitive, often recalcitrant women. I had always known that I was married to a good person. I have begun to think, since Ida's elevation to the presidency, that I may be married to a great one.
Gerald Early directs the African and Afro-American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. He's the author of a collection of essays called The Culture of Bruising. This is Fresh Air. The Viennese-born violinist Erica Marini died last November in New York at the age of 90. She had retired from the concert stage some 20 years earlier. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says she was a violinist's violinist, much admired by other musicians, including cellist Pablo Casals. Her recordings are rare, but Sony has just issued her live 1959 performance of a Mozart violin concerto. Here's Lloyd's review.
I never heard Erica Marini in person, and I never owned any of her recordings on LP. I don't think she made very many. Several of them have turned up on CD, and after I heard one, I started looking for everything I could find, without much success. There seem to be less than a handful currently in print. One of them, you have to read the small print to know she's on it. It's a Vivaldi concerto for two violins and cello, and her partner is another elegant violinist, Nathan Milstein. The Vivaldi Concerto takes up only 11 minutes on a 6-CD set on EMI called The Art of Nathan Milstein. Six or seven years ago, MCA reissued Erica Morini's beautiful performances of Mozart, Beethoven, and Brahms sonatas with the late Czech pianist Rudolf Verkushny, and a Tchaikovsky violin concerto. But these seem no longer to be available. A couple of years ago, Sony issued as part of its Casals edition her marvelous 1951 recording from the Perpignan Festival of Mozart's fifth and last violin concerto, the so-called Turkish, because of the Turkish-style interruption in the last movement minuet. It may be officially in print, but it's hard to find, and I won't tease you with it because Sony has just released another Morini recording of the same Mozart concerto from a live 1959 concert in Salzburg conducted by George Sell. It doesn't have all the drama or bite of the Casals performance, but it's wonderful in its own discreet way. I looked up Erica Morini in my late music teacher Boris Schwartz's book, Great Masters of the Violin. He describes her playing as communicative, with a controlled intensity. Despite her smoldering temperament, he writes, her body barely moved when she played. Her right arm, held low in the classical manner, was a model of smoothness, yet it was incisive when energy was required. Her left hand was a miracle of pure intonation, using a narrow vibrato that never obscured the core of the note, producing a tone of bell-like clarity. Professor Schwartz was usually right, and his description certainly fits what I hear on the recordings, not to mention the glamorous yet meditative photo of Morini in the CD booklet. The liner copy also mentions that a few notes into the piece, Morini stopped to retune her violin and then began again. That's not on the recording. What we hear is only perfection itself.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new Sony recording of live performances from the 1959 Salzburg Festival, including the late Erica Morini playing Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 5, with George Sell conducting the French National Radio and Television Orchestra. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf, research assistants from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Primary Colors, a novel of politics by Anonymous. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.